of us would have in our minds, a fairly light-skinned, blonde or brown-haired Jesus, thin facial bone structure, white robe, usually a blue or red sash. I've never known what it is with the sash. But anyway, why do we have this picture of a Jesus like that in our minds, many of us? Because it's come down to us through the art of Europeans who slowly transformed the Jewish Jesus into a more kind of white European-looking Jesus. But it's not only European artists who do that. In the last 100 years, there's been a thing called liberation theology, especially in South America, but in lots of places. And rightly enough, liberation theology has emphasized that Jesus was particularly interested in the poor and the vulnerable, the underprivileged, the kind of outcast or the those who are on the outside. But in doing that, liberation theologies often turn Jesus basically into a political revolutionary, like a Che Guevara with a crown of thorns on his head. And why did they do that? Well, because it was the political revolutionary types who were telling the story about who Jesus was, and they turn him into looking like them. There's a group of American, mainly white, kind of middle-class, kind of left-leaning academics called the Jesus Seminar. And they decided to do this thing where they looked at the Gospels, the biographies of Jesus in the Bible, and they decided to kind of choose which words they thought from Jesus were most likely to be authentic and which ones weren't, which sentences they thought were likely to be authentic and which weren't. And so they went through and did this, and the picture they came up with, kind of what Jesus looked like, and what they said, oh, this is probably what Jesus was really like. Funnily enough, Jesus said the sort of things that white, middle-class, left-leaning people like to say. Funnily enough, he ended up looking a lot like a white, middle-class academic. But it's not just that people like that. There's this is a real picture I found on the internet. Conservative gun-toting Jesus, often put forward by conservative gun-toting kind of people. Another one, and some time ago, a friend of mine sent me an article about an interview Elton John did in 2010, and he said this, I quote, "I think Jesus was a compassionate, super-intelligent gay man who understood human problems." He might as well have said that Jesus played the piano, because it sounds a lot like Elton, doesn't it? See, people remake Jesus in their minds into their own image, or into the image of the way they'd like him to be. But here's the thing. If we see a lot of people around doing that, the question we need to ask ourselves is, who are we likely to kind of reshape Jesus to be like in our minds? And let me ask you as we kind of get underway with this, and I'm not asking the person next to you now. I'm not asking the person who knows less than you about Jesus. I'm not asking someone else, oh, I wish they'd been here to hear this. I'm asking you, how do you think you are most likely to reshape Jesus in your mind? So often one of the ways we do that is by filtering out the parts of him we don't like, focusing on the parts that kind of suit us, but ignoring the parts of him that challenge us or rub up against our personalities or our preconceptions or our preferences. Now, all those examples that I mentioned before have elements of truth to them. Jesus is representative of all people, including Europeans. And that's what the original sort of European art was trying to show. Oh, Jesus is, he's representative of us. And that's right. Jesus was concerned for the poor and the marginalized deeply. So the liberation theology crew in that sense were right. Jesus did say things that come off very conservative today. So in that sense, the conservative gun-toting kind of picture is right. Jesus was also incredibly compassionate and intelligent. That's Elton John was right about that. But all of those versions then filter out elements to make him fit with the preconceived ideas of the different groups that are speaking about him. And the question for us is, how are you, how am I in danger of doing that? Because tonight's passage challenges us, I think, in just that sort of way. It's surprising the way it does it, but let's have a look. Great to have a Bible open. Mark chapter 1, verses 29 to 45 we're looking at. If you've got a black church Bible, it's page 858. If you've got a burgundy one, it's page 812. We're looking at verses 29 to 45, as I say. We'll look at these verses in three scenes. And then we'll talk a little bit more about what we see. But just before we get to tonight's passage, I want to just dip back a little bit to start to the passage we looked at last time, those of us who were here, 2 weeks ago, from verses 21 to 28, so just before our passage tonight. We saw Jesus and his disciples go into a town called Capernaum in the north of what's now modern Israel. And when the Sabbath, that's the Saturday, the Jewish holiday, when that came, Jesus went into the synagogue and he began to teach. And then, while he was in there, a man came forward who had dark power kind of influencing him, some sort of impure spirit. And it challenged Jesus, Jesus told the spirit to be quiet and healed the man from it. He cast it out. And the net result of all the stuff that happened in that synagogue was that the people there recognized that Jesus had an authority that astonished them, both in his teaching and in his spiritual power, and they realized they hadn't seen anything like it. But on the way through, there was something that raised a particular question, which is why I wanted to come back to it for a second. Why was Jesus so quick to silence that impure spirit? See, in verse 25, little number 25 there, as soon as the spirit had spoken, Jesus told it to be quiet. But what's odd about that in a way is that the Spirit had just said who Jesus was, said he was the Holy One of God at the end of verse 24. And we discussed last time this may have had something to do with at the time and in some of the documents that we've found from that time about exorcisms, there was this idea that if you said someone's name, you could have control over them. It may have something to do with that, that maybe the Spirit trying to get control over Jesus or something like that. It's hard to say, but the thing here you see clearly in this passage, Jesus had total authority over that spirit. It had no chance of controlling him. So it seems a little odd that he told it to be quiet as soon as it said who he was. It's not like he was scared of it. Why didn't he want, did he not want people to know who he was? Even if it was coming from that dark source, did he not want people to know who he was? Well, that's a question that our passage today brings us back to. So let's look into it. Scene 1, verses 29 to 34. Again, as we read here, we're taken into this scene, walking along in Capernaum after being in the synagogue. We're walking along with Jesus and his four disciples that we've met so far in the gospel. The four disciples are these two sets of brothers, James and John, Simon and Andrew. Quite likely here we're getting let in on the viewpoint of Simon. That's Simon, who was nicknamed Peter by Jesus, so Simon Peter. He was probably Mark's main source for this eyewitness testimony. So we're walking along with them into the home of Simon and Andrew. And there we find Simon Peter's mother-in-law. That always sounds like a cue for a joke to me, but I'll restrain myself, except to say that in the original language, the word for mother-in-law is panthera, which sounds a lot like panther, which is a big cat. And it always makes me wonder. But anyway, I'm just going to leave it there. My mother-in-law's great, by the way, so I better move on. Moving on, Simon's mother-in-law is sick. They tell Jesus, and he takes her by the hand, and he helps her up. And bang, she's better. Now, a fever can be serious today, but in the first century, a fever very often ended in death. But here, verse 31, just when Jesus just helps her up, suddenly she's well enough to begin to wait on them, to begin to kind of look after them because they're in her house and she wants to look after them. This shows the extraordinary authority of Jesus again. Even authority over sickness, even over serious sickness. And then verses 32 to 34, in the evening, after the end of the Jewish Sabbath, which ended at sundown, the whole town turns up on the doorstep seeking healing, basically the whole town. And Jesus, in his compassion, heals those who are weighed down with sickness, casts out demons who are tormenting people. He shows not only his extraordinary authority, but also his incredible compassion for the suffering. But did you notice again, at the end of verse 34, you get a strange little line again. But he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Why the big secret? We're told expressly he silences them because they knew who he was. Why? If he's the Messiah and the Son of God, as it says in the first sentence of the Gospel, and if God announced when he was baptized that this is my Son, then why the big secret here? Why stop the demons from saying who he is? Well, let's keep looking. Scene 2, verses 35 to 39. We now see Jesus go out the next morning, but it's still dark, so very, very early in the morning, to a solitary place to pray. Now, he'd had a huge, no doubt thoroughly exhausting day the day before, yet rather than sleep in, he thinks what he really needs is time to pray. There might be a lesson for us there about just how important prayer is, no matter what else is going on. But as he prays, Simon and the crew turn up looking for him. In verse 37, they say, "Everyone's looking for you, Jesus. Everyone's looking for you." See, Jesus was famous now. He was a local hero. More than that, actually, he was the one that people were excited about. They wanted more of him. He was that guy. And Jesus' response, in light of that, is kind of surprising. Verse 38, he says, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I've come." Now, that's not what you do if you're trying to get well known. I used to be in a band, kind of trying to make it, trying to get well known. And one thing we learned is that when you start building a fan base in one town, you go back there really soon and play again because you've got to build on it or it'll fade out. That's not what Jesus did at all. He obviously wasn't in the fame game, because instead of building on it, he says, "Let's move on." And why? Middle of verse 38. "So I can preach there also, these other towns. That is why I've come," he says. So he doesn't go where the people want him, but he heads off to preach elsewhere. Okay, let's keep looking. Last scene, verses 40 to 45. This man with leprosy. You'll probably see a footnote in your Bibles saying the word refers to different kinds of skin diseases. And that's what it is. This man comes up to Jesus and he begs Jesus for healing. So he's got a skin disease, some kind, and he begs Jesus for healing. And the man, he's showing incredible faith here. He says, "If you are willing, you can make me clean, Jesus." Now, to understand the man's request and why he uses the language of clean and things, it helps to realize what skin disease meant in that culture. What the implications of skin disease were. See, according to Old Testament law and social convention, people with skin diseases had to stay outside of towns. And they had to remain separate from others. And they had to call out, "Unclean, unclean." So in other words, they were thorough social outcasts. So it's very conceivable that Jesus may not have been willing to even interact with this man. That's why it's kind of, you can see the man's showing a lot of faith, but he's also a bit tentative. Many people wouldn't have wanted to come anywhere near this man. Verse 41 says, Jesus was indignant. Or if you look at another little footnote down the bottom of the page, it'll likely say, many manuscripts of Mark's gospel have filled with compassion here. A little aside here, this is an important thing to know. We have different ancient copies of the Gospels and of the rest of the New Testament, and there are occasionally small differences between them. Usually, it's very, very clear which difference is the original and which isn't, but in this case, it's actually a very tricky thing to work out. It's very closely balanced. Most of the time, it's very easy to see, and it's small difference. This one's a bit different, and it's tricky to work out. Perhaps Jesus was indignant, literally angry, because of the reality of the brokenness of the world and the effects of skin disease on people. Maybe that was it. Perhaps he was angry for some other reason. Or perhaps Mark originally wrote filled with compassion. It's hard to be sure in this case. We want to talk about more about that afterwards. I'm happy to. But either way, Jesus did have compassion here because he reached out and he touched this man. That was extraordinary. It should have rendered Jesus unclean, like a leper. We kind of get used to hearing it, but if we'd been seeing it, we would have gone, "Oh, what?" It's that kind of thing. But Jesus, in his compassion, touched this man. Who knows how long it had been since that skin-diseased man had felt the touch of another human being. And then Jesus said, "I am willing. Be clean." And the man was clean. Again, a debilitating illness, and this time with a social stigma, is gone. Just like that. But then, there's another strange thing. In verse 42, Jesus sent the man away at once with a strong warning. And that word strong warning is not even probably strong enough. It's with a kind of almost an angry challenge. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. Now, the offering and the showing himself to the priest might sound strange to us, but actually at the time, that's just what you did. If you were cured of a skin disease, it was very normal to go, give thanks, give proof that you were ceremonially clean, and then you could rejoin in with society and the Jewish rituals and things. So that was a normal thing to do. But the really strange bit here is Jesus saying, don't tell this to anyone. Again, we ask, why the big secret? Whatever the reason, it didn't work. Because verse 45, the man blatantly disobeyed Jesus and told everyone about what had happened to him. And the result was Jesus had to stay out in the lonely places, the wilderness places. Now the people still flocked to him, they still came to him, but he couldn't go into the towns anymore. And at this point he's a little bit like a famous person. Fame's a funny thing from what I've read about it. There's a lot of famous people who remark on the fact that they can't go places anymore. It's so hard. I know I'm a millionaire, but I can't go places. And they have to kind of watch their backs or have security guards with them. They're restricted. My wife, who I think is a very beautiful woman, if she goes out without makeup on, no one takes any notice. No one cares. But if a celebrity goes out without makeup on, it's all over the kind of social media gossip pages and gossip websites and stuff. Oh, it's great she could go out without the makeup on. Oh, didn't she look terrible without makeup on? It becomes a big deal. You're restricted. You've got people's eyes on you all the time. You can't just go anywhere because people are watching you and they might flock around you and they've got opinions about you. But there's a deeper problem with fame than that. Not only is it a restriction, but it can end up defining you because everyone wants to use you for your own ends. So the rapper and actor Bow Wow, who used to be known as Lil Bow Wow, until he stopped being little. He was a pretty big deal some time back and pretty famous from the time that he was little. And he said that a big issue for him with this was this, dealing with the fame and going from nothing and becoming something where everyone wants a piece of you. And Oprah Winfrey, the queen of fame, said this, if you come to fame not understanding who you are, it will define who you are. The point is, fame can own you because everyone wants a piece of you, and they want to define you. They want to make you who you want to be, and you kind of feel like you have to be who they want you to be, and all those kind of things. And there was something like that kind of situation, or that kind of atmosphere, that was beginning to happen with Jesus in this passage, I think. As I said before, it may well have been that when the demons and impure spirits declared who he was, they were in some way trying to control Jesus. That may well have been part of it. But with that, as they said who he was and everyone heard it, it would have fueled the fire of fervor about Jesus being God's long-awaited king, the Messiah. And at one level, that's all very well because that's who he was. That's what we're told in the Son of Mark's Gospel. He's the Messiah. But there were all kinds of ideas around about what the Messiah should do. For instance, that the Messiah would come and lead an army to set the people free and give them victory over their enemies at that time, particularly over the Romans who were occupying them. And that was the idea that many people had of who the Messiah should be, of what he should be doing, what they wanted him to do. You see that come up at various points in the Gospels. And so you can imagine them seeing Jesus. Oh. The demon said he's the Messiah. Oh, I've heard look at what he's doing. He's the Messiah. Oh, great. Let's get him to do what we want him to do. Let's get him to get rid of these Romans. And when the crowds were looking for Jesus in scene 2 when he was praying, surely that was because they wanted him to keep doing more of what he had been doing, to keep healing them, to keep doing amazing things, to keep preaching to them with astonishing authority. See, they had their idea of what Jesus should be and what he should do. They had their idea of the things that they wanted him to focus on. They had their plans for him. And when the word about him did spread at the end of that last scene, the end of the chapter, what was the result? Well, Jesus was restricted. He couldn't go into towns openly because everyone wanted a piece of him. They wanted to have him do, no doubt, what they wanted him to do. But throughout these verses, and also it goes on in the gospel, Jesus keeps silencing and slowing this down and putting the brakes on it. He refuses to give up his self-determination. You see, the people have begun to see, and we've begun to see from Mark's gospel, that Jesus is the Messiah, God's promised King, the Son of God. But Jesus ardently and passionately reserves the right to define what that means. He will show us what his idea of the Messiah is, what his idea of the role of the Son of God is. He gets to define that. And the crowds and us have to learn to look to him for what it will mean. And in the course of that gospel, that's what I trust he will do. Indeed, he's already started doing it. As we keep going through Mark's gospel, he'll slowly reveal to us more and more of what it means that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. And what he says about the work he came to do. And his idea of what we need. And what we need saving from. And of what is most important. And we need to let him show us. Or else, we'll do exactly the same thing that has been done over and over and over. We'll make a Jesus in our own minds that's actually reshaped in our own image or in the image of what we'd like him to be. And that we'll do that by filtering out the bits of him that we don't like and emphasizing the bits that fit with what we already think. And we'll end up distorting Jesus. Do you have a picture in your head of a Jesus reshaped into your own image or into the image of what you'd like him to be? Here's a few Jesuses, you'll forgive me for saying it that way, but a few Jesuses that I think we might have in our heads and our hearts that we may need to get, well, we do need to get rid of if we do have them, to make room for the real Jesus. Some of them might be the Jesus that I've remade in my image. I wonder if you can see which ones are the ones that you've remade in your image or a bit like the ones that you've kind of got in your head. And also maybe the ones that we have together. So here's a few. First one is Buddy Jesus. Buddy Jesus. This is a version of Jesus which I think many people in our wider society have. It's a bit like Jesus of the Bible, but he's interesting to hear about sometimes, this Jesus. Probably an important historical figure. I think he said some good things about loving your neighbor and not judging people. But that's about where we leave it. This kind of idea of Buddy Jesus doesn't require any more of me. He doesn't call me to anything else. He doesn't call me to repent and believe, to follow him. And of course, if that's where I'm at, well, I think that's fine because, well, I don't really think I need him. Why do I need him to call me to anymore? After all, he's just Buddy Jesus. But I hope you can see, even if you've only been here tonight for the first time, that is a long way. Buddy Jesus is a long way from the Jesus of the Gospels. A long way. Well, that's the first one. There's also the tolerant Jesus, the Jesus who would never offend anyone because he's such a nice guy, who doesn't say anything out of step with culture, who's politically correct and culturally sensitive and basically sounds a lot like a 21st century Westerner. I wonder if that's the Jesus in your head. Does the Jesus you think of ever speak back to our culture, including to the parts of the culture that you might like? Does he ever say anything offensive? Because the Jesus of the Gospels does say some pretty offensive things at times. The tolerant Jesus is not very much like the Jesus of the Bible. There's also a related one, sensible people Jesus. I remember being told once by a young lady who had been told this by her sensible sensible parents. She was quite young and it was a kind of kids program. And she told me this and I immediately knew where to come from. She said, Jesus wants sensible followers, not radical zealots. Now that's very comfortable for people living in respectable lives, who work hard and live in respectable houses and places and are nice, sensible neighbours and all that kind of thing. But the Jesus of the Gospels, as we've seen, calls people to give up everything and follow him. Because the kingdom is drawn near, he says, and it calls for repentance and faith. That's rather radical. It's not apparently that sensible, even if it does turn out to be the wisest of all paths in the end. And sensible people, Jesus is not the Jesus of the Gospels. Here's one, though, that might be a little bit closer to many of our hearts. Christian reinforcement Jesus. The Jesus who just keeps reinforcing what the Christians in our church, or the Christians in our little group, or in our background, our tribe, what we already think. He reinforces us and just says things that remind us how wrong everybody else is and how right we are. And does your Jesus ever challenge our church in the things that we're lacking in, maybe in ways we're disobeying him? Does he ever challenge your little tribe, or the kind of, does he challenge the background that you come from? The Christian background. I do wonder, I've been wondering about this for us, I've been wondering about this for me. For instance, in our active care for the marginalized, the poor and the vulnerable, Jesus seemed to care about oppressed people a lot and to encourage us to do the same, even though it's inconvenient and it's costly and it's non-strategic, some would say, and things like that. Seemed to care a lot. I sometimes wonder, if am I being challenged by that? Are we being challenged by that? Or are we filtering that out? Or in our overemphasis on the nuclear family. Jesus says some of the most radical words about giving up home and spouse and children and brothers and sisters for his sake. Some of the most radical words in the whole Bible. Just look at Mark chapter 3, verses 34 to 35. Mark chapter 10, verses 29 to 30. Think about how offensive those things would have been in that culture. He says some radical things about not overemphasizing nuclear family and in the place of church family and things like that. So do we let Jesus challenge us in areas like that, or do we just have him reinforce what we already believe? One more, and another one that I think many of us carry around in our heads at different times in different ways is this one. Dispenser Jesus. The Jesus who should give us what we want when we want it. I think you see this hinted at in the passage with the crowds and their desire for more healing. People sometimes say this sort of thing at a kind of big level. You know, if Jesus has power over suffering, why doesn't he stop it all? Why doesn't he heal all the amputees, fix the sickness, deal with the suffering, stop the natural disasters? Why doesn't he do that? Now, that is a fair and real question if you're genuinely open to an answer, if you're genuinely asking it. It's a fair question. And I think there are good answers to it. And of course, Jesus' answer may include that he's working on a different timeline to us. Even that he thinks there are some things that are even more important than ending all the suffering right now. He seemed to think that in this passage because he didn't return to heal but continued on a tour to preach his message. So sometimes he gets asked on that big kind of level. But on the personal level, we don't often say it out loud, but I think we often think it. We think of Jesus as a dispenser Jesus in this way. We think, Jesus, if you are there and you have power, you should heal me, or you should provide for me, or you should give me what I want. Where is my job that I've been praying for? Where's my spouse that I've always wanted? Where's my exciting life? Where's my respect from people? Where's my success at work or in study? Jesus, I've served you. I've worked hard for you. Why aren't you giving me what I need, Jesus? That's a dispenser, Jesus. Not there's anything wrong with asking him for things. He absolutely encourages us to ask him for things. But when we start thinking in that kind of way, where's my because I deserve it, because we start thinking like that, notice we are setting the agenda of what we need. We are thinking we can tell Jesus what he should really do for us. And then we're in great danger of having reshaped Jesus either into our own image or the image that we want him to be, rather than letting him be who he is. And of course, with all of these Jesuses, that's the thing. There's a better Jesus than all of these. The real Jesus. The only Jesus who actually existed in our world and continues to exist beyond our own minds. The real Jesus, the one who sets his own agenda, who we meet through the pages of Mark's gospel, who refuses to let himself be defined by others. The one who is the Messiah, the Son of God, and therefore who actually knows better than you or me what he should be. And indeed, he knows better than us what we need him to be. The one who, as we've seen, is full of compassion, who reached out to touch those who are untouchable and brought healing and life. The one who prioritized preaching the gospel, preaching the good news message of repentance and belief, and went from town to town to town doing so because people need to hear it and need to come to see that he is the one who brings forgiveness through repentance, who brings true life through believing in him, through trust in him. And of course, unless we're ready to let go of the Jesuses that we have shaped in our own image and in our heads and in our hearts, how are we ever going to accept him for who he is really? We'll keep looking to that one that's in our head instead of the true one. Unless we stop trying to domesticate and filter Jesus to suit our own desires, how are we going to let him set the agenda? So I'd love us all to prayerfully reflect on a couple of questions just for a moment. And here they are. In what ways have you reshaped Jesus into your own image or into what you'd like him to be? We've seen some examples, there may be others. If you can think of just areas where you're in danger of that or where you know you've done that. And are you willing to have the true picture of Jesus correct and challenge you in that way? Let's all, I'll sit down too and just have a think about that and pray about that for a minute. Then I'll lead us in prayer briefly.